Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be talking about Jack Russell Terriers. I'm delighted now to welcome to the program Susan Turetsky. She is the director of the New Mexico Landlord-Tenant Hotline. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Why, thank you, Mary Charlotte. I'm glad to be here, and I hope that I can be here again in the future as the executive director of the New Mexico Landlord-Tenant Hotline.
Well, and this is the thing. I mean, if anybody's been reading the papers, it's been in the news that the city defunded your contract. This is a contract that's been going on for what? How many years?
15 years I've been at the phone. 15 years. Approximately 3,000 calls a year.
That's a lot of calls.
It's a lot of problems to solve, and 3,000 calls a year. It comes in like 60 calls a day.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, let's talk about, I mean, this is, it's an interesting thing to me because I've been here in New Mexico for a long time, but before that I lived in the major metropolitan Boston area, and basically, if you had a problem, the landlords had their people and the tenants had their people, and ne'er the twain should meet. They were kind of antagonistic. But you talk to both landlords and tenants who are having problems, and so you have to be very impartial and really just take the side of what's right.
I take the side of the statutes. That's it, okay? I'm not an attorney, and I don't give any kind of legal advice. I don't give advice. All I do is give information. And there's 52 statutes that govern landlords and tenants in New Mexico.
And which you can probably recite in your sleep with the numbers and paragraph.
I certainly can. I have had in the past judges who have called me from out of state, from out of the city, out of the city of Santa Fe, and they'll say, you know, I know that I can research this, but I know you know it like the back of your hand. So what's the statute for less than such? I've had attorneys call me for the same reason.
Yeah,
it's all I know. I mean, I know it, and I know it real well. I mean, I go to bed at night and I put my head on the pillow and I say 47-8-36A4. I mean, I go nuts.
The statute that governs cat damage to furniture.
Exactly, exactly. I mean, that's, it just runs through my head continuously. So I can talk to the landlord and I can talk to the tenant, and the information is exactly the same.
Yeah. Now, the problems that arise most often are what?
Well, you know, how do I get my landlord to fix my leaky pipe? I don't have any heat in the house. You know, my roof is leaking. Things like that, where the landlord just ignores the tenant. Another issue, of course, always is that comes up frequently is where the landlord doesn't return the security deposit in a timely fashion, which the law requires, okay? From the flip side, the tenant isn't taking care of the house, the tenant isn't paying the rent, you know, and there are rules, there are laws. When I was a kid growing up, which is a long time ago, although I sometimes think I'm still growing up, the my favorite game was Monopoly. And I feel that this landlord-tenant stuff is just like playing Monopoly.
Interesting.
These are the board game rules.
Yeah.
And when somebody steps aside from the rules, I say, wait a minute. We got to look at the statutes, okay? Because the judge doesn't legislate from the bench. The judge doesn't make up the rules. And if the landlord or the tenant is going to appear before the judge, they're going to do real well if they take a copy of the law with them.
Now, in your view, are the laws pretty fair? Are they good laws?
I think so. I mean, they're not perfect. But I think they're pretty good. I mean, it's very clearly defined. I'll give you an example. The deposit, okay? The law, it's 47-8-18, deposits. Tell everybody.
We don't need to know all the numbers.
Tell everybody that I don't have the copy of the laws right in front of me.
No, she doesn't, ladies and gentlemen.
Anyway, the law says that the landlord shall, and shall in legal language means they have no choice. The landlord shall send a written notice, and any payment required, a written statement of deductions, and any payment required to the last known address within 30 days of the termination of tenancy or when the tenant moves out, whichever is last. And if he doesn't do that, the law goes on to say that he forfeits every defense he has under the deposit law. Can't keep one penny of that tenant's money for any reason whatsoever.
So if the landlord doesn't give back the deposit, And 31 days go by, and on day 32, he or she says, well, you know, you did punch my wall and break the drywall, and you did do this, and you had water damage, and your hamsters ate the rug. Doesn't have any defense.
No, you could have had a trained gorilla tearing the place apart, and the landlord has no defense, okay? As soon as that tenant moves out, at the end of the contract, or when the tenant moves out, whichever is last, that clock starts ticking for that landlord, and they better know that. They better have all the paperwork ready.
So what are some other kinds of problems that you see? In other words, what are some of the more unusual ones?
Well, I'll tell you the story about this young woman who came into my office recently. She is a young mother. She's got three kids, single mom. She's on Section 8, and Section 8 is a federally funded program which pays a good percentage of the rent. And she gave her landlord $1,068 as a deposit. And the
is a lot for
sure
somebody on Section 8.
Sure it is. She needs that money. She needs that money for her kids. Anyway, she moved out of the property. She cleaned it up. She turned the keys in. She did everything the right way because she wanted to maintain her Section 8 certificate, and she wanted her money back. And 2 months later, she came into my office with big tears in her eyes, and she said she hasn't heard from her landlord. He won't answer her phone calls. She's called him on and on. He won't respond. And she didn't know what to do to get her $1,000 back. Well, you know what? To me, that $1,000 probably represents 6 months of food for her kids. She needs that money, okay? And it's outrageous that the landlord did not respond to her, either by mail or at least return her phone calls. So we sent the landlord. I gave her a demand for deposit letter. She mailed it to the landlord, and that demand for deposit letter gave the landlord a week to return her full deposit, or she would take him to court. Well, we're in the process right now. We're waiting to see if that landlord forks over the $1,068, and if he doesn't, she's going to come back in, and I'm going to get her ready to go to court pro se, and you know what? She's going to win.
Right, because he's forfeited his defenses.
Exactly, exactly. Another story that came into the hotline, you know, this has been going on for 15 years, these stories. This guy lived in a trailer, and he was moving, and he told the landlord he would clean the carpeting, and she said, oh, don't bother. She says, you don't have to clean the carpeting because I'm going to replace it because my family's moving in. So he cleaned everything else up, left the carpeting the way it was, waited, moved out, turned the keys in, did everything right, got his security deposit letter back within 30 days, and guess what? She charged him $575 for replacement of the carpeting.
Good heavens.
Good heavens. So I talked him through a dispute of damage letter. And in a good dispute letter or a demand letter, you should always tell people what you want, by when, and what's going to happen if they don't do it. So, you know, he summed it all up. He wrote it. I can't write it for him, but he wrote it. And then he wrote, therefore, I am demanding $575 within 5 days of your receipt of this letter, or I intend to take legal action against you. And then you know what? He can go right to the magistrate court, which is the people's court. You don't need an attorney to go to the magistrate court. And then it's going to be up to the judge.
In cases like that, where it's one person's word against another, how do they decide? I mean, it's just who the judge believes?
Well, you know, it's the one who has the most documentation that's the one that's going to win. And he did send her emails. There was some correspondence between them. So he's in good shape. He should get his money back.
So one of the things that you have and that you were able to give out for very low price, like I think I remember a couple of bucks because I've been through, I mean, you and I met before I started doing radio because I had some extremely deadbeat tenants who no longer live here who were horrible.
And I remember when you walked into my office and you were mighty unhappy.
No, and it's like, what do you do? You know, on the one hand, you feel sorry for them because they're, well, anyway, but we won't go into that. But what is interesting is that you have a lot of documents that are there. You have leases that people can fill in, and you've got all sorts of, like, the types of letters that you're talking about that are there and ready to go so people don't have to reinvent the wheel.
That's right. That's right. You know what? I have, in the hotline, I have a landlord's kit that we, you know, I get a $30,000 grant from the city. I have gotten that grant.
Which is now seems to be gone.
Seems to be ending, okay? And after the $30,000, generally speaking, I'm able to generate another $14,000 in funds because it takes about $45,000 to run this company. From the money, I have to pay rent, I have to pay taxes, I have to buy errors and omission insurance, I have to pay an accountant. There's a lot of things that I have to pay out of this, okay? So it's not a... It's a 501c3. It's a nonprofit, and it's it just runs right to the end line. Okay,
you apparently are not getting rich doing this.
No, that's right. You got it. But you know, I have this landlord's kit. It's a disc, and it has every single piece of paper that a landlord needs to run an effective business. And it is a business. It's got leases, applications, all the appropriate forms, notices, move-out letter, security deposit, settlement letter. It's got advice for the tenant to get their own insurance. It's got a complete copy of the statutes in it. It's got a handbook, and it's got every piece of paper you need. And I sell that for $60. I have renter's guidebooks that we have in the office that are available in Spanish and English for landlords and tenants. I have a newsletter that I publish six times a year. It's called The Landlord's Guide. And what I do, my major in college was English literature, so I can write. And also going back to ancient history.
Your bright college years?
No, even ancient. I won the sixth grade spelling bee. So I'm a good writer and good speller. Anyway, I write a newsletter. I take each statute and I go through that statute until there's nothing else to write about. The deposit law, a resident's rights following a fire or casualty, every statute I can, payment of rent, etc. So I have that. I have I do six workshops annually, two for tenants, two for landlords, and two for licensed realtors and property managers for five continuing credit hours. I was approved to do this by the New Mexico Real Estate Commission. I do court preparation pro se. I do mediation. People come in. I have landlords and tenants. I send each party out of the room, talk to each one individually, bring them both in together. I have a letter from a previous judge who said that I've done a great deal to reduce the court load. I have letters in my office.
If I may say
yes.
So, that's a huge part of this. I mean, when you talk about, you know, the city is saving $30,000, and I hope that you being a 501c3, you will continue and just do a little bit of fundraising because it's certainly not an impossible task to keep the hotline going independent of the city contract. But when you think about how much money is saved when people end up settling without going to court in the
Absolutely.
First place, it's huge.
Absolutely.
I mean, I don't even know how you would calculate it, but it's probably in the hundreds of thousands of dollars.
I would not disagree with that. I had one tenant call me, and he was going to be evicted for non-payment of rent. And he wanted to know what the process was, what's going to happen to him, what about his stuff, everything else. How fast did he have to leave? When is the court date? What is the judge? Is there any chance? You know, and so on and so forth. So I told him, you have no chance. I said, you got to pay the rent. The landlord's entitled to his rent. And we talked, and I said, you're going to be evicted, okay? But here's what I want to tell you, mister. Pack up your stuff, because the law says that after the eviction, after the execution of the court-ordered eviction, the law says that the landlord only has to look after your personal property for 3 days. After that, he can run it through a chipper if he wants. No further notice, no liability. So you run a huge risk of losing your personal property. And that was, I mean, that's what I do in the hotline. That's what's been going on for 15 years.
I mean, you get so many calls a day, and you're there alone. How do you handle them all?
Oh, it's, I'm on automatic. It's just landlord-tenant hotline. How can I help you? Next caller. And, I just take it right through. I don't let them go off on stories and everything else. I don't want to hear it. I just want to get right to the facts. I'll give them the information. And then they're consumers to me. They're not clients. They're consumers. So I give them the appropriate information, and then I tell them, now you have to make a decision for yourself, okay? Whether you want to fight this or you want to go to court. But if you're going to go to court, you're going to have documentation.
We're talking to Susan Turetsky of the New Mexico Landlord-Tenant Hotline. Now, how much are you dealing with, for example, on the landlord side, people who are running apartment complexes versus somebody who's renting out their little garage apartment or their next door house or whatever?
Both. I get calls from property managers. I get calls from apartment building owners. I get calls from apartment building managers, people who have, you know, like you say, they're running a room out in their house. Sometimes I get calls from people who, this is real interesting. There's, it's called unlawful enforceable entry, statute 47849.
There you go again.
Unlawful enforceable entry. And that's when somebody's in the house without your consent, okay? Here's a call that came into the hotline. This woman said, I let my son and his girlfriend live in my little guest house. They broke up. They had a big fight. They broke up. My son left. She's still there. I told her it's time for her to leave. She said, I can't leave. I have nowhere to go. She says, how do I get her out of there? Well, you can't drag her out of there. You have to write her a letter. And all the laws of unlawful enforceable entry apply to the landlord-tenant laws. So I told her, you got to write her a letter. You got to give her 3 days to get out of there. If she's not out in 3 days, you tell her you're going to court. That's what the letter needs to say. And then you go to the judge, and you ask the judge to remove her from the property. She's holding onto the property without your consent. She's not a tenant. It's not a landlord-tenant issue.
Right, right. Now, there is an organization, I mean, in the paper yesterday, one of the things that, there's a front page article, and I have to say, the number of people writing letters to the editor of the Santa Fe New Mexican who are supporting your work has been incredible. I mean, people, I didn't write, but I should have. I mean, and I would have, and I'm saying it right now. I mean, you helped me tremendously. The number of people you've helped is extraordinary. But the article in the paper that was, where the city officials were talking about how the service was redundant because there's a nonprofit in Albuquerque called Law Access, and that does the same thing. Tell us about Law Access.
I don't know too much about Law Access. It's in Albuquerque. You have to be eligible. You have to qualify. You have to be low income. Okay. And if you're not low income, I think you have to be, it says 200% above the poverty level.
Right.
In order to get, you know.
I think the paper said $22,000 annual income.
Yeah, but it's, like, but if you call there, they say $20,000.
Okay.
So if you're a moderate income landlord, you don't qualify.
But can you pay then?
You can pay. They charge, I don't know. The paper said $30. I'm not sure that that's correct, okay? I know that they will refer you to legal services. So it's not redundant. It's not the same service, okay?
They can't call and get a kit with the leases and all that stuff.
That's right. That's right. This is a resource, okay? My door is open. I've been in the same office for 15 years. My door is open, okay? People walk in. I mediate. I work with both sides together. It's a completely different thing.
And when they, I mean, you pay $30 and then you get referred to a lawyer, then do you have to pay that lawyer if you do Law Access?
Yes.
Ah.
Yeah.
So $30 is just the beginning.
I believe it is.
Okay. Now, you have materials in Spanish and English. Do you get a lot of dominantly Spanish-speaking folks?
I do. Lucky for me, I took 4 years of Spanish in high school, so I can speak un poquito.
You can probably spell, too.
Yeah, a little bit, right? But, you know, I'm very disappointed in the decision that the councilors and the mayor made, because I know that they said in the article that another reason that they did not feel that it was necessary to fund the hotline was that I'm not an attorney and that so much of this is legal advice. And that simply is not true. I'm not giving advice, period, period. I'm just giving information to consumers. You know, years ago, I used to reply. The Consumer Protection Division of the Attorney General's Office forwarded all their calls to my office, and I used to reply in writing to these complaints that people sent into the AG's office. And I would copy the AG with my response. And the AG's office called me, and they wanted to put an 800 number in my office, which I did. Well, you know, I'm a one-woman band, and the onslaught of calls was overwhelming with this 800 number, and there was no additional compensation given to me. if there had been, I could have hired an assistant
yeah.
to help me with this. You know.
Who you would have had to have memorized the statutes just as you did.
That's right. That's right.
Basically.
But it didn't work out that way, okay? My loyalty was always to the city of Santa Fe. So that I just kept it there. Now
do you serve people outside the city?
Yes, but they have to pay for it.
Oh, okay.
Because the grant has been always just from the city of Santa Fe, and I've been very fiscally responsible with the city's money.
What kind of, are there any differences between people who are in the city and who are calling from the county or the outlying areas?
No, they're all state laws. It's all the same.
Ah, okay.
Mm-hmm. And I get a lot of calls from Albuquerque for people who could, you know, avail themselves of Law Access and have told me for one reason or another they weren't satisfied.
We're talking to Susan Turetsky, director of the Landlord-Tenant Hotline. How has you've been doing this for so long, you've seen up and down economies, but how has the current down economy affected the calls that come into your hotline?
Oh, that's a good question. You know, that's a very good question. I think you should be a counselor. I think you should be a minister.
Be quiet.
That's a very good question. You know what? The economy is very unstable. The politics, the political situation is very unstable. People are nervous. They're agitated, okay? This is the worst time to stop the funding for the hotline. This is the worst time for the hotline not to be available for the people.
So you have had more calls.
I've had so many more calls on unpaid rent and foreclosure. A lot of foreclosure because...
How do you handle that? Because that's not a landlord-tenant thing. That's an owner, homeowner thing.
Yeah, but I can give them information, okay? And I know that information. Foreclosure, under the statutes, 47.821, it says that, you know, they talk about if the property goes into foreclosure, if it goes for sale, if it goes under foreclosure, whatever, whoever takes over that property becomes what's called the successor in interest. And they're bound by the terms of the lease that's in place, okay? So if you've got a one-year contract and that property goes into foreclosure, you've got a lease, okay? And the bank has to honor that lease.
So the bank can't kick you out, and then let's say my house is foreclosed on and the bank owns it, then you buy it and my lease is, and the lease is still...
That bank has to, it becomes a successor, they have to honor the lease with two exceptions. Number one, if they sell the property to somebody who wants to move in as their principal residence. Number two, if it's not a bona fide written lease, okay? Those are the two exceptions. But if the new buyer, let's say that the bank sells it to somebody who wants to move in as their principal residence, the new buyer has to give the tenant 90 days written notice before they can take possession of the property. Other than that, the bank has to honor that contract.
Right.
And that law starts out by saying, unless otherwise agreed. That's very important because the bank will call you and say, you got to move out of the property. We took it over. It went into foreclosure. And so if you move out, that was an agreement. Nobody stuck a gun in your back, okay? So you're in a position, tenant, where you can say, you know what, I'll be happy to accommodate you, but you're going to have to pay me because it's going to cost me money to move.
Right. And I think one of the things that happens if you're dealing with unscrupulous people is even those who know the law, they might just say, they might write you a letter. This sounds very official. Says you have to move out
by
Tuesday.
That's right.
And if the tenant doesn't have the information, then they say, "Gosh, I have to move out." But then you provide the information of what the laws are, what the statutes are.
That's right.
And then
right.
they can defend
there's
themselves.
There's another law that kicks in, and that's Helping Families Save Their Home Act of 2009. And then also, if it's a month-to-month tenant, instead of 30 days notice, they have to give them 90 days notice to move out of the property.
Ah.
If the property goes into foreclosure or if somebody else wants to move in, 90 days. So there is protection for the tenant. Okay, this economy is tough. It's tough. A lot of tenants are not paying the rent. The landlords can't pay the mortgage.
Right. I have a friend who, she lives out of state, but she is pretty much living hand to mouth. And if her tenant does not pay, she's got people living in rooms in the house and she has a little extra unit. If her tenant doesn't pay on the first of the month, then she's in financial trouble.
She
can't even take it on the second. I mean, she's in a very, very tight schedule, and a lot of people don't realize that their landlords are barely squeaking by.
That's right. Landlords are not typically deep pocket people. There's a reason that they're landlords, okay?
Right.
I mean, there are many of them in this town who own a lot of rental properties, and they're doing just fine, okay? But there's a lot of them that are, have inherited properties. You know, maybe they're renting rooms in their home just to make it, you know, make it possible to exist in this economy. This is a tough economy right now. Inflation is taking over. You only have to go to the grocery store. The price of gas is high. I mean, this is very, these are unstable times. It's the worst time not to have an office with an open door where people can come in and get the help that they need.
Now, Susan Turetsky, just because the city is no longer going to make a contract with you, that doesn't mean you have to go away. I mean, you're a 501c3 nonprofit, as are about 4 gazillion other nonprofits here in Santa Fe, and they all have boards, and they all do events, and they all get by. So will you be doing the same thing?
Yes, I think I'm going to. I think I'm going to take a look at this. I know that this is possible. I know that I can look for contributions from people. If anybody wants to make a contribution to the landlord-tenant hotline, it's a 501c3. It's all tax deductible. They can mail a check to the landlord-tenant hotline, 664 Alta Vista, Santa Fe, 87505, and I will look into having silent auctions, events, to see if we can keep this going for the people. I have been here to help these people for 15 years, and it's my intent and goal to remain in place.
And we certainly hope that you do so. Since this contract was canceled, I know there have been all these letters to the editor. Have you also gotten calls at your office?
I've gotten so many calls at my office, so many calls. I didn't initiate all this. I mean, it's an onslaught since Saturday. And I just told people that I think that the city is not going to fund the hotline anymore. That's a decision that the mayor and the councilors have made. I'm sorry to see that happen, and I know that a lot of people in this town are sorry to see that happen, too. And maybe, you know what?
You can go on. I mean, if you think about all, I'm just going to say this. If you think about all the people who have gotten incredibly good service and, frankly, have saved a lot of money in the past, there's no reason why you wouldn't have a huge base of support to keep you going.
I think I will. And you've given me a lot of encouragement, and I'm going to think this through very carefully. I'll talk to my board. I will see what I can come up with and see if we can keep this important resource available to the people in this community.
Now, for me, as an animal lover and a dog owner, I can't help but wondering, are there any landlord-tenant disputes that involve animals, either that have done damage or whatever?
You know, animals are interesting. I'm a dog lover, too, and I had a dog for 17 years, Duffy. I adopted him. That was his name. I wouldn't have chosen
Duffy.
It myself, but that was his name. He was a little black French poodle. He lived with us for 17 years. We used to put him in the middle of the car on the console of the Jeep and take him for a Dairy Queen every Sunday. Anyway.
He wasn't a human.
No, we thought he was. Anyway, I had a tenant call me. No, I'm sorry. It was a landlord that called and said that the tenant moved in with 2 dogs, and the lease says no dogs. And so he sent her a notice of noncompliance because she had dogs in the house. Well, it turned out that one dog was actually a seeing-eye dog.
Ah.
The other dog was a companion dog. And there is such a thing as a companion dog. Okay,
yeah.
She had a letter from her psychiatrist that said that she couldn't function without this little dog and the
big dog. She needed two?
She needed two. The big dog was only eyes. The second dog was a companion. So I said to him, under fair housing, she's entitled to keep those dogs. She's got documentation. She had very minimal sight. So she had the big German Shepherd for her eyes. And the little guy was the love of her life.
Was her psychiatrist.
That's right. Kept her going. So, you know, you can you can say no dogs in a property, landlord, but you cannot get around eyes. A seeing-eye dog is not a dog. It's a pair of eyes. And a companion dog with a note from a psychiatrist is a companion.
Very interesting.
It is.
And honestly, a dog like that, especially a seeing-eye dog, I don't know about the companion, but a seeing-eye dog is so well-trained.
Absolutely.
That it's not going to do things like, I had once, my rental property is actually my mother's house, but when she wasn't there, I used to rent it out, and there was this one woman who came in, she had a Rhodesian Ridgeback.
Oh, I know those dogs.
Who would get on the couch and claw the windowsills.
Yes.
I had to hire somebody to sand them down.
I had a tenant like that, and the dog ate up the whole windowsill in the living room. The whole windowsill. We ourselves, my husband and I, had a German Shepherd at one time. And I had bought an antique table for the foyer in my house. This was in Michigan. And we went to bed. It was a colonial. We went upstairs and we went to bed. And I heard, while I was laying in bed, I hear,
oh, no.
And I couldn't imagine what that was. Went downstairs in the morning, and I had a three-legged table.
Good heavens.
He ate the whole fourth leg.
So Ladies and gentlemen.
Dogs can do damage.
Dogs can do a lot of damage. Although I have to say, cats tend to do more, because they will claw your couch
right
to death. Not all cats will. I had a tenant once who didn't tell me she had a cat, and I had a no cats policy. And I went to see her the day she moved in, and there was this cat. And I thought, oh no.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the cat was fine. And she gave me her word that the cat wouldn't claw the furniture, mm-hmm. and the cat didn't claw the furniture. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. you know, some cats are good cats.
Worked out well. That was a good cat.
So Susan Turetsky, the executive director of the New Mexico Landlord Tenant Hotline, the number over there is 983-8447. You are still going.
Until the end of June.
Until the end of June.
That's
and
right.
Then you've basically got to come up with donations to keep going.
That's right.
So
that's right.
You will let us know when you start to have events. You are accepting donations at, what was the address again?
664 Alta Vista, Santa Fe, 87505.
So you will accept donations there, and you will have events, and we will announce them. And I have to say, I hope the city can come together to keep this valuable service going, because you do a great job for so many of us.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
We're going to take a break. We'll be back in just a moment. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Catherine Romaine Brown. She is the author of three different books on Jack Russell Terriers. You breed Jack Russell Terriers, you love them, you train them. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. I also started Russell Rescue because so many people get this dog and they don't realize they're like a loaded gun.
Yeah.
That they need a lot of output, and you need to keep up with them, and you need to make their lives interesting and fun.
And so some people get a Jack Russell Terrier because it's cute, and it's got to be the cutest thing ever, especially when they're puppies, and then they can't handle them.
Absolutely. Or they find that they harass cats. They will stalk birds in cages, and they have a lot of drive.
Now, how did you get involved with this particular breed?
I had the first one given to me, and I became addicted to them after that.
And so you started, it's one thing to love them, but it's another thing to actually get involved with the breed as a breed and start writing books about it.
Yes, actually Howell Book House came to me. Terry Batzer, who is our director of the Jack Russell Club, our person in charge of the office, was supposed to do it, and she didn't have enough time, so I fell into it, and the first book did so well. The second book, The Courageous Companion book, came out, and then they asked me to do the third book, and there are different variants of the Jack Russell now. There's the Parson Russell Terrier and the Russell Terrier, so there's more variants, and it gets confusing for people, but I'm very much dedicated to the real Jack Russell, which is the original breed.
Now, this breed is a fairly recent breed in the history of breeds, as breeds go. What, a couple hundred years old? A
couple hundred years old. And everything about the Jack Russell was modeled after the Red Fox, the European Red Fox. Courage, tenacity, intelligence, hardiness. And they were a strain of terrier. So they were totally built for going below ground in dark earthen tunnels and evicting the fox from its den so the chase could continue.
And so they were bred for fox hunting and certainly used for that. Now people get these dogs that are bred for very strenuous work, and they put them into apartments and expect them to be lap dogs. Doesn't work out so well.
Doesn't work out, because if you don't give them enough to do, they find things to do that's not good. I one time got a call at midnight from somebody who wanted me to come and remove the Jack Russell from his apartment. And I said, why? What's happened? And he said, it's shedding. They shed quite a bit, and they are high-action dogs.
Now, if somebody gets a dog and they don't know that it sheds, they just don't deserve to have any kind of dog. I'm sorry.
Well, there are a lot of people that use dogs as fashion accessories, and dogs are real feeling personalities that live with us, and they are long-term relationships. This breed can live to be up to 20 years old, so your larger dogs frequently don't live as long. But these dogs stay active almost to the day they put all 4 feet up in the air.
Now, when you get a Jack Russell Terrier and you are not, let's say, a hunter or a rancher or a full-time hiker or mountain guide or something, and you can take the dog out working with you 8 hours a day, what kind of activities make the dog happy?
Well, if you go to terrier trials, there are all kinds of things. It's like taking them to Walt Disney World because they can race, they can do simulated hunts, go to ground exercises below ground, and have a lot of fun. So there's things to do with them. And if you don't hunt, I would suggest agility because it uses the mind and the body of the dog very well.
What you do agility with one of your Jack Russell Terriers, what is that? What does it look like?
Well, you've probably see it on Animal Planet frequently. And it's there are people like Greg Louganis that does agility. And the dog goes over a series of jumps and tunnels and up and down contact obstacles, dog walk, a seesaw, A-frame. And they're trained to do it, and they'll only do it if they love it. So everything is positive. It's all about positive energy and the dog listening to your body and moving as you move and you direct the dog. And they'll set up traps so the dog is best to learn the names of the obstacles so you can direct them. It's sort of a timed race around a course. It's a lot of fun and a great outlet for their energy and intelligence.
And they are very intelligent dogs.
Yes, they're very intelligent dogs, and they don't take to being bored, because if they come up with their own activities, it's not good.
Yeah, they often involve couch dissection and things like that.
Yes, interiors of cars, digging holes in the garden, so you can't let them be bored.
Yes. Yeah, I have two Jack Russell Terriers, and one of them used to just find ways to dig out of the yard, but it was so stealth that you could never find the hole. But she would get out, and she would go out, and I think she was buying pizzas because she always came back with pizza crusts.
I have one named Zinnia that can climb a fence like a human, and I've put a top over it, everything. She can still get out.
Now, how do you do obedience training with a dog that smart and that willful?
Well, I don't know too many that are really great at obedience. They seem to like agility better because it's a moving discipline, and I say discipline with a small d, because they still make their own choices as they go along, and they don't always qualify in the runs. But you don't see a lot of brilliant obedience Jack Russells. There are a few, but even the recall is a big thing to get from a Jack Russell, because they're very willful, and you better be interesting and have a lot of reward. It's best to train them when they're a little on the hungry side, because if you don't keep it interesting, they're going to turn the channel.
We're talking to Catherine Romaine Brown about Jack Russell Terriers. She's the author of various books on these crazy animals. Now, these dogs are, of course, terrific hunters. Are there still people who do hunt with them?
Yes. In fact, field work is an important part of the Jack Russell Terrier Club of America, where dogs are rewarded for their valor in the field. They simply have to go below ground, locate, bay, bark, or bolt the quarry. The Jack Russell was never intended to have harsh contact with the creature, the quarry below ground. They were to bay and bark and mark why the handler dug down to the quarry. So they're really, Jack Russell said of the terrier that their intelligence should keep them from such a crime. They weren't supposed to really mix with the animal they confronted below ground.
The reality is that if given half a chance, they will kill and consume any rodent of their size or less, sometimes more if they can handle it.
Yes. Well, a fox, they're bred to hunt red fox, and that's formidable quarry. So something, a lesser animal, is certainly going to get their focus.
Milk's brother hunted a porcupine, if I recall correctly.
It doesn't surprise me. There's no limits with these dogs. You really have to protect them like a 2 or 3 year old.
How are they with children?
very well-behaved children. They're very good with. I don't recommend them, nor does the Jack Russell Terrier Club of America recommend them being in households with children younger than five, unless they're watched, and never leave a Jack Russell or any dog alone with a small child. And it's not always the Jack Russell's fault. Sometimes children can be very cruel to dogs when nobody's watching.
Like pulling their ears and things like that.
And the proud little Jack Russell is not going to put up with any kind of physical abuse.
What about with cats? What about with other non-dog pets?
Not a good idea. I mean, they'll sit and stare at a gerbil for hours thinking of ways to get in to get to them. So it's not a good idea, and it's not good to have two of the same gender together because sometimes they will also have arguments.
Two of opposite genders sometimes have arguments, too.
Yes, they do form very strong likes and dislikes for their own. And I know when I take Twister to a competition, he's really polite now. We call it good social when he walks amid all the big, dark dogs, which he would probably put boxing gloves on if he weren't so well trained. But when he sees another Jack Russell, they frequently do this high five, how are you doing? And they'll tune into each other.
Yeah, they know this is one of my cousins.
Yes, they seem to know each other. And especially when they meet in a playing field, like in agility, they'll go, hey, it's one of mine.
So they're very smart. They're very agile. They can do training. They can do hunting. They will eat cats. They will eat gerbils. They'll also eat birds.
Birds, yes. One of my favorite stories about Jack Russells is a friend of mine had a Jack Russell that jumped up in a shrub, ate the sparrow whole, just ate it right down in a panic. That he called the veterinarian and said, what should I do? My dog just ate an entire sparrow. It's gone. And the veterinarian mused for a moment and said, may I suggest an orange sauce? So you have to take these dogs with a grain of salt. And they do use them at SeaWorld. They're used to keep seagulls from landing. And so if you give them a job, they're very, very happy. Or if you keep a good schedule with them, keep that schedule with them. They like to know certain times they're going to get a walk or they're going to be played with. And if you do live in a limited space, as long as you give them 15 minutes here and there, perhaps 15 minutes in the morning or 15 minutes to a half an hour at night of intense, you playing with them, throwing a ball, throwing a frisbee, giving them yourself wholly, they will usually settle down and be great companions. But you can't ignore them. Ignoring a Jack Russell is the biggest punishment you can give them.
And they will punish you in return.
Oh, yes. I had a friend who once was traveling cross-country, and he had a few crosswords with the dog before they left. I don't know exactly what the dog did. But the dog, for about 12 hours, stared out the window and wouldn't even look at the owner.
The sulking dog. And what's funny is that there's such a strange combination of absolutely vicious killers, strong as can be, fast as can be, and then you get into the house and they look like a kind of 19th century Odalisque draped out over the couch, the laziest, most languid, sleepy dogs in the world.
They're truly hedonistic dogs. They really love comfort and they love adventure. I like to think of them as being a 21-year-old in a sports car with a lot of gears. And they're not vicious killers. They're just functional hunters. I don't like to think of them as killers. I mean, they are little clowns in thug suits. I mean, they're thugs in clown suits.
Well, I mean, certain chipmunks Milk has known would certainly think of him as a vicious killer.
Well, yeah.
I mean, he'll swallow them whole.
Yummy.
They're treats.
It's a meat course.
Now, when Jack Russell Terriers get older, they're known for basically, first of all, living very long lives, but also really keeping their energy almost till the end. What do you have to watch for and be careful with when these dogs get older?
Sometimes they'll have hearing loss. They might get cataracts. People get cataracts. Dogs get cataracts. They might require a special diet. You do have to give them trace minerals that are very good for them. They might rotate from fish to chicken. They might have problems with losing teeth as they get older, or things like that where they really need softer food. But you keep an eye on them, give them what they need, and they can live for a very long time. You have to keep them exercised and not let them be too lazy as they get older and not get overweight.
There are a lot of dog breeds that are just overbred, and dogs with hip dysplasia problems and dogs with gastric problems that are a result of overbreeding. That hasn't happened with Jack Russells, as I understand.
No, they're a strain, and they do have other breeds in their background, and we're proud to say that they are a strain, where there's no need now to breed other breeds into the Jack Russell because there's a large enough gene pool now where it's not necessary. But in England, they would, in the past, breed another breed in when they needed perhaps a little hardness added to the hunting if the dog got too soft. And there are styles of working. And a hard terrier is the one that will pursue a cat, and a soft terrier is the one that will sleep with a cat. So there are different styles, and so they were breeding different breeds in, but that's not done anymore.
What were some of the breeds that were bred in the past?
Well, the Dachshund, which you can see the influence sometimes in. The Beagle was actually in the past. The Italian Greyhound, the miniature Greyhound, was in the background. But now they've evolved, and there's really no need to add other breeds in.
Any other things that people should know when they're considering getting a dog, getting a Jack Russell Terrier, about living with them, about their care, about these dogs?
Well, it's a little like the Brady Bill. I'd suggest that you take 3 days. Think about it. Read about the breed. Study the breed. Go to the Jack Russell Terrier Club of America's website. You can get a lot of information right from that website at terrier.com.
Terrier.com. Somebody bought a domain name early on.
Yes, and there's a lot of information there. There's even a small test to see whether you are actually a good match for a Jack Russell.
And apartment living in an urban setting is just not a good match, whereas country or even suburban living where there's at least a yard seems to be kind of the criterion.
Containment's very important because they will take off. And they have been known to stay below ground for up to 2 weeks without food or water if they are hunting. And there have been cases I myself have had to have a dog dug out. I wasn't out hunting, but the dog discovered a fox below ground and went below ground, and it required a backhoe to get my two dogs out.
Good heavens.
Yes. And the founder of the Jack Russell Terrier Club of America, Elsa Crawford, had to dig up her pipes that went her whole drainage system from her house out because her dog went up in the narrow pipes.
And you couldn't just
No, and you can't find them.
Oh, goodness. I was going to say, just hold cooked liver at the entrance to the...
No. No, as they are single-minded. If they are working, they are at work.
Catherine Romaine Brown is the author of several books on Jack Russell Terriers, and we're lucky enough to have her as she is visiting Santa Fe. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.